So the Mishnah on Daf Gimel and Aleph tells us about a number of different possible scenarios which may or may not be connected. So that's a part of it. And there's one principle that it seems to not be talking about, and that's what we want to talk about. Because it's a din that comes up on the Gemara on Daf Yudalit and elsewhere. And I'd like to just consider it a little bit and what the implications are. So there's a notion you got a chance to see that Reb Meir maintains in Dalet Amid Beis, the mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames, that it is a mitzvah to fulfill that which a dead person says. Now, most dead people don't talk, but the assumption is that he said this when he was alive, and it refers to when he is no longer alive. So there is some kind of a din that we have to fulfill it. So if I told you such a din, what questions would you have right away in terms of just trying to understand that din?
Well, it's not halachic.
Okay, is it halachic or not? So that's an important question. Now, it's some kind of halachic. Well, let's...
I meant, let's say they tell you, like, eat bacon or something.
Sorry?
Like, let's say they tell you to eat bacon.
Oh, what if the... I thought you meant something else.
Yeah,
now, what if the instruction... Okay, yeah, that could be an interesting question also. What if the instruction is not halachic? So, clearly, there's going to be limits to it.
Yeah.
But I thought you meant... I'll come back to what I thought you meant. Let's see what else. Caleb, you had a question?
Oh, I was going to say what he said.
Okay, so presumably we can take it for a given, you would think, that it doesn't apply to contradicting halacha. But it's not as obvious as it sounds, actually, because there is one significant area of halacha which may not seem to come to mind first, that this may indeed interact with. Well, we have to know also whether it's Dais or Darabanan. That's also... I thought you were asking, like, what is the halachic significance?
Maybe if it's a Daraisa to honor their request, let's say they're asking you to, like, go against, like, a Darabanan halacha. Would the Daraisa maybe be...
Okay, that's an interesting question. But there is an area of halacha where the Torah says something, and this may indeed interact with it in a contradictory or overriding way. Any clue what I'm talking about? So it's... Well, Kirav Aim is actually a way it may relate to in a complementary way, although actually maybe sometimes in a contradictory way. There's an interesting discussion about that also. Okay, so we'll accept that answer. But Yerusha, yes, this is where this is most significantly relevant. And so this is a thought to keep in mind as we learn a little bit about this, because the halacha does give rules, the Torah gives rules, for what happens to a man's property when he passes away. There is very specific guidelines for the most part, and we don't have latitude, it seems. Now, is that absolutely true? We'll see. But it seems like that what happens is automatically the property is assigned to the heirs, and the Torah tells us who the heirs are. So that is something which has gotten a lot of discussion nowadays. So the issue of inheritance and whether someone can have any control over how to dispense with his property is a matter of great debate. And nowadays, there is a trend in general that people write wills and that the wills generally don't seem to look like what the Torah describes. So, for example, Al Pi Din Torah, so basically the property goes to the sons, if there are sons, and is divided equally between the sons, and if there's a Bechor, then the Bechor gets double for most things, depends on what. And the daughters generally don't inherit. Hi.
But don't we mention, I forget where it is mentioned, I think later in Gittin, that a father has the ability to take away property that he gave to one son and give it to another, and so can't that just be used as a...
When he's alive.
Right, but can it be used as a guise that while he's alive, he'll move the properties around, and then when he passes away, then when the properties are given over, they're changed.
So in general, so let's just finish describing the scenario, then we'll come back to that in a second, but given that that's what the Torah describes, so essentially, if you have sons and daughters, so the daughters, Al Pi Din Torah, don't inherit at all. And one son, if he's a Bechor, is going to inherit more than the others. And nowadays, you rarely, I mean, I can't say speak for the whole world, but very often, wills are written that don't follow that specific plan, and very often, it's about all the children inheriting equally. So, there are a couple of questions to explore that are only partially relevant to the sugya, but it's worth keeping in mind. So is there a halachic way to do that? And it seems like there is, because again, this trend is not simply in circles where they're not traditionalists, but as some Sfarim say emphatically, not all Sfarim, but some Sfarim say emphatically that this is really the proper thing to do, b'zman hazeh, that one should make sure to include all of his children equally in the inheritance. And this is certainly done, not to say it's done everywhere, but it's done in all circles, meaning that there's no segment of Judaism where it's not done at all. So if that's the case, so how do we square that with the din of the Torah? And let's say it's really two questions. So one question is, halachically, how could you pull it off? Right? And keep in mind that we've talked about this year things like Mechiras Chametz and Prizbol and things like that, where it seems like there is something that is working around the din, and we talked about in each case whether that's legitimate or not, or spirit of the law, letter of the law. So here, the question is also, even if we can work it out, letter of the law, so what about the spirit of the law? How does that play into it? That's what we wanted to address.
I thought you were asking what mechanism you use. I was going to say, Hefker doesn't have Hefker.
So that we don't really have here. So what David brought up, it should work theoretically. The big problem is that you have to do that when you're alive. So when you're alive, you can basically do anything. That sounds very ambitious. But when you're alive, as far as assigning a property, so yes, you can give it away, and you can decide who to give it to. And that theoretically gives a lot of latitude. I wouldn't say there's no limits, but it does seem to give a lot of possibilities as to how you would hand it out. So some have suggested that, making a matana mechaim, that making a gift when they're still alive, and having it conditioned that it should take place a moment before death, which gets into other issues, exactly how that works and if that works. But we're not going to get to this, not necessarily our topic today, to get into all the different strategies than there are, but as far as relates to our sugya specifically, I want to keep in mind two points. One point is this a path to it? Is this idea of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hametz, is that relevant to that goal, if that's the case? And secondary to that, or together with that, if it's not, does it have any relevance at all? Does it have some kind of secondary relevance that may still impact the question of utilizing other such approaches? Okay, so far so good. So what else would you want to know about mitzvah l'kayim divrei hametz?
Yeah. This was brought up much in the chorus, but the idea of shkemi rak, k'sivim dano, how do they, it seems like if you have shkemi rak, why do we need this mitzvah l'kayim divrei hametz? If he's on the brink of dying as a shkemi rak, what's this halacha adding?
Okay, so that's one question. Let me clarify that, actually. So shkemi rak does sound like it kind of overlaps. So, but there are differences. So Shchiv Meirah is a takana of Chazal, that, and that's probably what we're talking about here overall, that the dinim that come in this Mishnah, it's Maimed Shlashdan and Shchiv Meirah, and then Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hametz comes up later, they're probable they're all dinim d'Rabbanan. When it comes to the source for Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hametz, it sounds like it's a Drabbanan. The Noz of Yehuda has a pretty wild tshuva where he works off the assumption that it's Drabbanan. It's hard to glean so much from the tshuva as quoted in that context. If you read the tshuva, we'll talk about it a little bit. But it's hard to glean too much from it, because basically he's refuting the whole scenario. Somebody said there's a whole situation like this, and do we have to listen? And he's like, what? Not for this reason, not for that reason, not for another reason. So it's hard to know what to gain from it. But it sounds like it's drabbanan. What we will see is that there might be some hints to it, min ha-Torah. There might be, especially when we get to the secondary level, there might be something to talk about min ha-Torah. But as far as it being absolute din, sounds like it's drabbanan. So just 1 second. So Shchiv Meirah is a different din. Shchiv Meirah is if a person is sick already. Doesn't have to be that sick, but he has to be sick that he thinks that he may die from this. This is different than a goses. A goses is a much more advanced stage of being in the process of dying already. Shchiv Meirah means that he's concerned that this illness may bring him there. So then he can declare something as a kinyan. And in the context of Bava Basra, where it comes up, it's talking there about moving around the Yerusha. So we just mentioned that we can't really move around the Yerusha. So Zaitin and Bava Basra, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that you can within the Yorshim. So let's say if somebody has three sons, so they were going to get 33, 33, 33, so then he can move around to be 50, 25, 25. Is that a good idea? So this actually overlaps with some themes in the Parsha. Right? One of the major messages the Gemara has in Shabbos from the Parsha is Olam al Yishne Adam Banav Ben Habanim, Banim Ben Habanim, Banav Ben Habanim. It shouldn't Ben Ben Habanim. Person should not favor out one son among his other sons. It doesn't necessarily end well. But let's say for whatever there's some reason that you want to move this around, so that you can do. And the way Shchiv Merah works is that he makes this declaration at that time, and we say, okay, the deal is signed, sealed, and delivered. It's actually the literal translation, like Kiksuvan and Masurin Dami, that it's basically done. Why is it done? Because this was a concern that we don't want him to get worse, that if a person is in this situation, so he's very vulnerable, and he could get agitated. So we don't want this to impact on him negatively. Shema titarif daito. So they made this din that it should be chal. It should take effect. So that is different than what we're talking about mitzvah kain divrei hames. Mitzvah kain divrei hames, the person could be totally healthy. But he makes a declaration that this is what I want to happen afterwards. So it's not happening now. It's happening specifically after he's no longer alive. And it's not part of this special din of Shchiv Merah that takes place only at that stage of illness. And if the person recovers from that illness, so then the Shchiv Merah declaration is canceled. It's only a consequence of that. So Mitzvah Kain Divrei Meis is really coming with a different kind of mechanism. Hi.
So another question on Mitzvah Kain Divrei Meis.
Yeah.
When exactly does it take effect? And Rabbi mentioned the Shachas Kodem Misa. How does that play in?
Yes, that's a whole different concept. That's about a matana mechayim. So that is, if a person wants to give something and he's alive, he totally can. And that he can just do whenever he wants, theoretically. But if a person wants to use that to kind of maneuver around inheritance law, so the point is that he wants to keep it until he doesn't need it anymore. But if he waits until he literally doesn't need it anymore, then he loses control. So he wants to work it out that way. Here, he's trying to have something happen after he's no longer alive, specifically. So, how does that work? So, one of the major questions to figure out, and especially in the context of this daf, is this kinyan? What kind of a din is this? And a part of the issue is brought up, Gemara has it on Daf Yudalid, in the name of Remeir, and it seems like we do paskin like that, like we hold like Remeir that there is such a din. But Tosfos brings it up over here, if you had a chance to see the Tosfos. So Tosfos has a view which a number of Rishonim share. Maybe not everybody, but it's a popular view among the Rishonim. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch also. In fact, it's not the only view in Tosfos, but in the middle of Tosfos, Tosfos has this idea in the name of Rabbeinu Tam that raises the question, the Mishnah, which talks about this whole concept, that if a person makes this declaration that somebody should give some money to a certain person after he dies, so then they should do it. So first the Gemara and the Rishonim try to figure out what's going on with the two cases in the Mishnah, because they don't seem to totally parallel. Are they coming from a common concept? Are they working the same way? It's a little hard to make the two halves of the Mishnah work out together. So the Gemara has an effort to try to see if it's possible. So the Gemara eventually says that what's going on here is the Maimed Shlashdan. There's this other din that involves somebody passing on a chov to somebody else who's there, and that's what's going on. It's another Kinyan Midrabanan. So Tosfos asks, why do we have this whole effort to try to figure out what's going on here? We know what this din is. This is Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames. So isn't that the simplest? So what's the difference between what was described in this Mishnah and the din of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames? Seems like it's a pretty good example. So if somebody says, T'numan Elish Ploni, Hames, Yitnu Lachem Yisum. So apparently that's not an example of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames. So why not? So if you saw Tosfos, one of the approaches that Tosfos gives a few approaches. You know, one approach is that the one that makes it into most places, the one that makes it as a halacha, is, at least according to some, is that keeping in mind that we are trying to deal with some kind of a Yerusha-related concept here, right? Because we're dealing with the dispersing of somebody's money after he's no longer alive. So being that the money has to, it doesn't explain exactly this way, but this is probably what's, presumably what's behind it, being that immediately upon death, everything goes to the heirs. So how are you going to create that kind of a control? If a person says, I want my property to be given to somebody else when it's not mine anymore, how does that work? So Tosfos here and elsewhere suggests that normally it's not going to work for that. The only way it's going to work is if you were mashlish it with somebody else beforehand. So let's say a person is anticipating he wants to give out money to his daughters. So he decides how much in advance, and he gives it to other people to hold. And then he says, okay, so when I die, you should give it to them. So then maybe we would say mitzvah kind of rames. But that's not what's going on in the Mishnah. So that's a different case. We can't explain that with mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames. But that is would be a requirement. So that's an important discussion, practically speaking, whether or not that's the case, or whether or not it's always the case, or whether or not anything else could equal that. So that we'll keep in the background for a second, but for example, as a possible strategy for Yerusha, so that's going to be complicated if that's true, because you would have to then give it all out to other people beforehand to then have them distribute it afterwards. So what else is at issue here? So to go back to what I thought was Eric's question before. So how do you understand this din? So let's assume it's a din drabanan, like it sounds like. I'd like to know to be who to assume. The Nod Behuda was just, if you want to know what his tshuva was about, it was talking about this case where there were two brothers, and one had a daughter, one was single, and one was married with a daughter, and there was a discussion about the daughter marrying the single brother, right, which nowadays you don't see that too much, but the Gemara says in Yavamos that that's recommended because the uncle will take good care of her. But the brother didn't want to. It was Shimon and Levi, and Shimon didn't want to marry Levi's daughter. And Levi was pretty upset about that. And Shimon and Levi were pretty close, but they got into a little bit of a fight about that. And then when Levi was about to die, so he's still angry about this, and he told his wife that, I know that when I die, everyone's going to want Shimon to marry the daughter, and no way, I don't want it to happen. So then he passed away. So those of you who Huda talks about, does that authority apply? So it's a good test case. What would you guess is the story for that?
Can you repeat the case?
The case is that this man, on his deathbed, told, or actually any time before, it didn't have to be Davka then, but it was though. So he told his wife that after I die, I don't want our daughter to marry my brother.
Well, did he originally want them?
Originally did, and then it sounds like the good story that he got upset, like he wasn't a big enough dowry, and he was offended, and so once upon a time, that was a havmina, now...
So Shimon did want to marry her?
Now, yeah, after he died, Shimon Taki did want to marry her, and he knew that because no one else was going to take care of her. Apparently, it was the whole story that after he passed
but
away, there was going to be a lot of pressure.
Couldn't he just give his daughter Yerusha while
so,
he was alive?
It's not about Yerusha here, that's the thing.
No, but she'd be taken care of because she would have...
Could be, but
if he gives her his Yerusha while he's still living.
Okay, but let's... The question is just, as far as this instruction, he tells his wife, don't let our daughter marry this guy.
Makes sense.
No, I assume it would work because a lot of the reason why it wouldn't be like a good advice is because he would just be upset and it'd be like a lack of keeping him, whatever, but not that it doesn't apply if he's dead, but if he's not there to witness it, then there's probably something to be made out.
You're saying it shouldn't work, you're saying.
So it's something what he said shouldn't work.
Shouldn't work.
Because he's not there to see it.
not that it doesn't, that the Kibbutz Rabbeim doesn't apply after he's dead, but the reason why he didn't want, he sort of, he has no say now. He's dead, like.
So it's interesting. As I mentioned, this is true.
He's in the picture, yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of reasons why you shouldn't be able to do it is because he would be there and be very upset that you.
He can also engage her before he dies, right? Like he can get her engaged to someone else before he dies. So if he has
Now she's an adult.
Right. Not if she's an adult, but if she's younger. Okay. I don't know how old the girl is.
She's an adult. Because he already turned her down for marriage before, so let's assume she's an adult.
She's an adult already?
Yeah.
Okay, so then what choices does he have here then?
Okay, so then you're going to
say that.
You're going to vote with Yehuda. Okay.
Well, no, I was going to say that he doesn't.
She should listen
to
him.
It's her choice.
It's her choice, yeah.
Okay.
Her body or
yeah.
Is in the case is he can only marry her if the father dies, right?
No, he could marry her anyway, yeah.
Oh, okay, no.
Yeah, that's not
I thought it was,
that.
Oh, never.
So that's why it's hard to glean what his conclusion would be, because his basic point is that this is not going to take effect at all. And he mentions in that context, he says, because of the Din Rabbanan, we're going to worry more about that than about the other things. And among the things he points out, and this is something we talked about early in the year, and we talked about the Marik. The Marik's position, you recall, is a good opportunity for Chazara while we're in Chazara mode. We talked about the Marik in the beginning of the year, that the Ramah quotes, yeah.
That parents can't enforce marriage decisions upon their children.
Exactly, right. So since a father cannot tell a daughter who to marry, who not to marry, the din in Shulchan Aruch talks about a son. Pashtus is true about a daughter also. Pashtus is no difference. Those of you who mentions that in the Tshuva also. So since he couldn't tell her when he's alive who she can marry and who she can't marry, so it's hard to say that now he can tell her from beyond the grave. So your point was just coming from the Kibbutz Ava'im angle, which now we'll mention that. So Kibbutz Ava'im, you're right, so he's not around to see it, so how much should that matter? But we're not asking only from that angle, we're asking from the Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis. So what exactly are the boundaries?
It's stemming from, you have to listen to your father.
Okay, so
if that doesn't apply, then there's
so
no...
So it's an interesting question. So you're saying something, which is in Swedish.
No, but it's
Okay,
from keeping off that situation.
Okay,
no, she still has that mitzvah. If he said, don't marry this guy...
Because he's dead, he you don't have to listen to him for whatever he said.
Okay, but it's still a mitzvah.
You have to listen to him because he was your father.
Do you agree to mitzvah, though?
Okay, so you bring up a couple of interesting points. This is why I asked you. Because you bring up a couple of interesting open questions. So one question is it true what you just said, that there's some kind of connection between this din and Kibbutz Ava'im? We haven't seen that so far. Now, we don't know that that's true. Now, it might come out to have some truth to it, but we don't see that so far, and especially that could have been an easy answer for the Mishnah. How come the Mishnah is not using that as the explanation, right? Because there's nothing in the Mishnah that indicates that he's instructing his son Tavka to give this money to somebody else. So we don't know from the Mishnah there's any connection here to parental rights specifically. Now, just to explain, even if we weren't talking about this, if we were talking about Kibbutz Ava'im, so you're right that the father's not there to see it. However, the Gemara does say in Kiddushin that there is a din of Kibbutz Ava'im Acher Misa also. So theoretically, Kibbutz Ava'im does apply even if the parent's not alive. But Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Mudei Or and others explain that is still a different kind of din. So that's going to be relevant to what you're saying, that the idea of Acher Misa is a din, you say Kaddish, you name the yeshiva after him, something like that. You do things that bring honor to the parent. But the idea of Kibbutz Ava'im, that you follow their instructions, it's always a question in the Rishonim if you follow the following instructions is actually required by Kibbutz Ava'im. But there's some sort of idea that doing what makes the parents happy is a part of that din. So they like to see a certain thing, you should do that. So especially if it's relevant to them, right? So that we know. Kibbutz Ava'im in its most clear sense in the Gemara is service. So if you bring something bring the newspaper, that's Kibbutz Ava'im in the clear sense. So that whole concept, that's what Kibbutz Eger says, it does change in nature after the parents no longer alive. And then presumably it's about something else. So if they had said, listen, I'd like it when you wear a purple shirt, so there's no such inyan afterwards to Davka wear a purple shirt. But anyway, when the parent was alive, that's the Ma'arik, right? That the Ma'arik says that they don't have control over it anyway, over marriage. So if that's the case, so why should it be more when he's not alive? So essentially he's dismissing all the different aspects of it. So it's hard to know from his tshuva where it really does apply. But while he's saying this, he's saying that there is a din rabbanan here, and that's not going to outweigh all the other things. Yeah.
Can you say that? He can't force you to marry anyone. But again, we're saying it's a mitzvah, meaning that simply by the fact that he's requesting that from you, you don't have to do it, but it's a mitzvah. Just like I don't have to put on tefillin in the morning, but you should. It's a mitzvah.
Okay, so that's an important question. That's one of the major questions we're going to figure out. We say mitzvah, what kind of Abraham is. We know that in Shas, in general, mitzvah can mean a lot of different things. So what are the possibilities of what mitzvah means here? Chiyuv could mean a chiyuv, like in the sense of absolute obligation. What else?
Could also mean like a chova, like you could do it if you want to.
No? I mean like something that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay. What else? Well, one question also is that, is there a notion that there is a actual kinyan here, especially considering the neighborhood of these dinim, even though it's not really brought up here in Taf Yudalid, but Tosfos is bringing it up here, the other Rishonim assuming that it could have been one of the examples here. So, or like you mentioned before about Shchiv Meira, and the point that it seems to be somewhat in the neighborhood of Shchiv Meira. So, is this a kinyan? Is that what's going on here? Is this when the mace is mitzavah something? So, does that create an actual transaction that's binding halachically? So, some think this is a machlokas rishonim. That, if you saw, I called your attention specifically to Arashi and Daf Yudalad and Ibeis. Where, see Rashi, but how the mismakabel b'chayyeh nosim? So let's say the person he wants to give it to passes away when the person who's giving it is still alive. So then yachzeru l'mishaleach, you should give back to the person who is supposed to be sending it. Dulo zacha behen mikabel. So it sounds like what this would have meant is that when it works, that mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis means there's actually a kinyan. That's how some read the Rashi, to say that there actually is a transaction that happens with mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. Others, Machne Ephraim, believes this might be a machlokas between Rashi and the Ran, because the Ran gives a different explanation to the whole question of why we need a special takana here, why we need different dinim. And he suggests that it's because maybe we're dealing with Yusomim Kitanim, who are lav b'nei mevid mitzvah ninu. They're not subject to a mitzvah. So that brings up the question, like David was maybe alluding to, is that, well, what is this? Is this a reality? The property just shifted? Or is this a mitzvah, something you got to do with it, but the property is still not yet transferred. So if it's a mitzvah, so then maybe Yisomim don't have this mitzvah. So the Machne Ephraim interprets that run to say that it's not a kinyan, hasn't actually transferred, it's just something that the Yisomim should do. And if the Yisomim are not adults to be chayiv mitzvos, so then they're not going to be subject to this, so we need to have other types of methods in order to make this happen. So what other question, let's say to go back to the Nod Behuda's case, so what other reaction could you have had to dismiss that besides the limitations on marriage? But what else maybe would you read that tshuva and say, well, I wouldn't have thought this would apply anyway, because is it so clear that this is something that applies to all kinds of behavior, even if it wasn't as personal as marriage? That is, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis means that you can give instructions for how people should act. So the Tashbetz, for example, has a tshuva where he writes that he thinks that, or he takes it as a given, he says, what happens just because a person dies, they become king of the world? And is that how it works? And we're just going to have control over other people from behind the grave? Is that a special power? In general, you know, this whole sugi kind of brings that up because, you know, like Rav Schechter often points out, that people think that there's a concept of kavod hames, which the way people sometimes relate to it, it means that you can treat people miserably when they're alive. But then as soon as they die, it doesn't matter now, you have to go speak ill of the dead. And it's also a topic this week's parsha. That's a good trivia question. How's it a topic this week's parsha? Okay, maybe I'll mention that on Thursday. But that's a real mystery that we'll have a hard time finding that one. But the idea that all of a sudden you have to start respecting people because of kavod hames, so as he often explains, is a din of kavod abrios in general. We have to respect human beings. And that din is so powerful that it continues to apply even when they're not alive to see how they're being treated.
Is this the Tashbetz or Refshech?
No, that's Refshech's point. So I'm just saying that it's not a new concept, a new power. All of a sudden the person deserves respect. It's an extension of the din of Kavod HaChaim, the Kavod HaBrios, that continues to apply. So too, the whole idea of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames. So what happens? All of a sudden they get these new powers? That they can tell you what to do? Is that the idea? So Tashbetz assumes no. He assumes that this is only related to one's money. And it is related to the din of Nachlos. It's related to the Parsha in the Torah of inheritance. So that itself is significant. Connecting it in some way or another to the concept of Nachlos, I think, has some implications in a few directions, but hi.
Didn't we talk about this like how kind of you missed by get? So how is that?
So not by get, actually, because we're assuming that there's two different dinim in the Mishnah. That there was an effort to try to get the Mishnah to line up, the two different dinim. But the Mishnah says that when it comes to a get, so then there's no point of a get for Nisa, because the marriage is ended already anyway. We talked earlier in the year about somebody who wants to have a get go in effect right before because they want to avoid Yibum or the like. But otherwise, after the husband's not alive anymore, so there's no concept of a divorce. So that's why the Mishnah says that regarding the first part, may slow you to Achimisa, but if it's money, so then there is such a thing. So, and that's, we don't even know if the Mishnah is talking at all about Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames, but, or it sounds like it isn't, because that's not what the Gemara establishes as. But the Tashbetz is assuming here that this is a Nachalos-related concept, or it's inspired by the idea of Nachalos, the fact that the Torah has this concept, and it's not something that means you can control the world. It means that you have some say in your property and how that's going to be dispersed. So that's interesting on a few levels, I think, because, just to put some thoughts out there, that, first of all, the idea that it's connected to Nachlos, if you want to say it's a din d'rabbanan, so then what I would take it to mean is that the Torah has a notion of one's property passing on to his family after he passes away. And what Chazal are building on, if they're seeing a connection there, is that on some level the Torah is concerned with what a person would want after he's no longer there. And that there's some inyan to fulfill that. And that's how some of the Rishonim understand the din of Nachlos in general. So this svara, if it's true, I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that it limits it to property, which we can kind of understand. But also, the idea that it's within the world of Nachlos is itself interesting. So, because what I mentioned at the outset, whether this sugya is relevant at all to modern day efforts to kind of rearrange inheritance, I think it's a question on two levels. So one question is, could this do it? Could using Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames, could that actually halachically rearrange the inheritance. And secondary, let's say we can't. Let's say it doesn't work, right? So, for example, if you take Tosus's view that it has to be Mishulish in somebody else's hands, so then it sounds like it's not going to help. Right? It sounds like we generally usually don't have the setup for this to create a new inheritance. But let's say we use a different method, and tomorrow we'll spill into this a little bit if you want to explain some of the other methods, just very briefly, some of the other methods that are used. But if you use a different method, so how much should we worry about the fact that this seems to be evading the Torah's ratzon? Right, so that's something we spoke about at length. We talked about prosbul and related issues. So here, let's work backwards for a second. And so the fact that in so many circles, and I can show you many svarim, that, for example, if you went to the Day of Learning last year, when Willick spoke about wills and inheritance, and he very strongly encouraged using one of the techniques involved to give equal inheritance to all the children. So if that's the assumption of many great poskim, many great rabbanim, that that's what should be done, some method should be used to make sure that happens, so why don't we worry about thwarting the intent of the Torah? Right? If we spent all that time with Prisbul trying to figure out how Prisbul was consistent with the goals of Shemitah's Ksafim, why don't we worry when it comes to Yerusha in a similar way? So I think it's a hard question, and I could spend a lot of time talking about it, but you know, the simplest answer, that's not necessarily enough of an answer, but saying the most likely answer, is that it's really not in keeping with the spirit of the Din of Yerusha. But the issue of Shalom and Machlokas that could happen, again, look at this week's Parsha, is so significant that that's given higher priority as much as that. But that opens up a lot of questions also. So didn't the Torah anticipate that? And you know, is that really, are we really comfortable just letting one value completely crowd out another? So I think it works a little better, or maybe there's a little bit of a hint to it, that if what the Tashbetz is saying is that in general the reason Yerusha exists is because the Torah has a recognition of what a person's presumed desires are with his property, and that's what the whole concept is meant to bring about, so then maybe there should be a little bit more latitude to allow the person to say what he wants to happen with his property. Now, that may not be halachically enough to make it happen. It may not be considered a kinyan. It may not be considered effective for whatever reason. But it may be a spirit of the law explanation. So the idea that it's not completely thwarting the Ratzon HaTorah is maybe the Ratzon HaTorah is essentially coming from what the person is presumed to want. So that's something to think about. We'll have to just dip in this a little bit tomorrow. I'll just mention very quickly, we'll dive into it in a second, which to give a sense of this. So there is a big discussion in poskim about contemporary wills, and there's a minority view, but Rav Moshe Feinstein is one of them, so that's pretty big, even though, despite being Rav Moshe Feinstein, this is many did not accept this, but Rav Moshe was of the view that a secular will is effective to override the Dinei Yerusha of the Torah. So how that works is a good question. A lot of different ways to explain it. But Reb Chaim Ozer Kaczynski has, writing before him, Reb Chaim Ozer Vilna has a tshuva, two tshuvas, one tshuva in the third chelek of Yachiezer, and another in the fourth chelek that was published later, but it's clearer in the fourth chelek, where he thinks, I'm emphasizing thinks because he writes that he's noted this way, that he says he sees that people are writing regular wills and that Bati Din have been enforcing them. So he thinks that maybe it could be due to the Malchus Adino, which is a question whether that should kick in. It's also a given topic. But he suggests that maybe it's possible Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis does have a role here. So what about the Rishonim that brought in Shulchan Aruch that it has to be Davka if it was Nishlash in somebody else's hands? So he suggests that maybe the writing of the will is no less than that. that dad has specially given, that the government, the secular government, is going to enforce it. Right, that that basically has the impact of giving it to a third party beforehand, which is a pretty huge chiddush, is an interesting idea. And he says at the end, after saying that, he says, "Lo matzasi gili mefurshu." I haven't seen this necessarily fully explained or endorsed, but he was known to think that way. So it could be that there is some relevance here, that maybe there is a possibility that this could actually pull off the rearranging of the will, even on a technical, functional level. That's very much a minority view, but it could be that that's a possible mahalach. But even if it doesn't, maybe there's more room to say also that it is something that is in the background, that there's a value here the halacha recognizes also, so that one who does utilize a different technical method in order to make that happen is not necessarily thwarting the intent of the Torah, and especially to the extent that we see mitzvah kaim divrei hames representing a mussar value, and that's how some understand it. Rav Asher Weiss in a few places writes that. He writes about this in at least three places, because he has a Sefer on Gittin, so you can read that. He also has a Sefer al HaTorah, so this is very much a Vayichi topic, right, as you can imagine. And he also has Tshuvos about this, because this whole issue of inheritance, as you can also imagine, is one that very frequently comes up, and how to address that. So in all three places, he talks about this, and he understands it to be a Musar value of the Torah. It's not necessarily a absolute mitzvah, an absolute din, but it's something which, certainly source-wise, it's something that the Chazal understood to be part itself of the Ratzon HaTorah. So how that then impacts on other aspects of the Ratzon HaTorah is a fair question. Okay, so we have a few more points about this tomorrow, and then we will jump into Chazara. And do we have a...